there is a risk, and that we're going to have another 5 to 10% correction sometime this summer, probably closer to the election. But again, as long as these major sectors are on bullish buys, that's all it's going to be. It'll be just a correction.
Welcome to Thoughtful Money. I'm Thoughtful Money founder and your host, Adam Taggart, welcoming you back at the end of another week for a weekly market recap featuring my good anti-fragile friend, Lance Roberts. How you doing, Lance?
Yeah, anti-fragile is a good word for it today. So,
yeah, well, let's just quickly talk for a second about why you're in a different environment than our normal weekly market recaps and what's gone on in Houston over the past 24 hours.
Yeah, so just we had just massive storms over the last 20, really starting late yesterday afternoon. We had these storms that kind of blew through, and wind speeds reached between 80 and 100 miles an hour. We've had major power outages all across the city. 885,000 people currently without power, and it could be days or potentially even a couple of weeks before power is restored because it actually knocked down big power transfer systems. So again, it's you know, there's been four confirmed fatalities from this, but again, just, you know, you had hurricane speed winds blowing through Houston with massive rainfall. So it's been, and the reason I'm in a different place today is we have no power at our house. So it's just trees are blown down, big oak trees are laying on top of people's houses. It's pretty bad.
Yeah, you sent me footage from your street, and I mean, yeah massive trees down, and the pictures that are coming out online about, you know, elsewhere in Houston. I mean, in many cases, it looks kind of like a bomb went off. So very sorry to you and the folks of Houston. I hope you guys have a swift recovery from all this. Folks, maybe we're going to have to get used to this new background for Lance. If you start seeing, you know, him getting 5 o'clock shadow, growing a long beard, you know, looking like maybe he hasn't showered in a while. It's just because he's that committed to these weekly market recaps.
Exactly. Well, no, fortunately, where our office is located, we have power. So fortunately, there's a gym downstairs. I've got access to the gym, a deli, showers. So I'm okay. I'm going to be fine.
All right.
I may be living in the office for the next couple of weeks, but we're okay.
I was going to say, reverse the work from home movement. You're now back to the office, and maybe you'll never leave now that you've gotten so cozy there. But anyways, super appreciate that you doing this, you know, really still in the aftermath, the immediate aftermath of all that's gone on there. Not similarly, it's not nearly as much of a hardship as you, but have been traveling in my home office literally for about another 45 minutes to an hour while we do this, and then I'm off again. So we're a little more loosely structured than we are normally. Didn't have time to prepare a list, even though there's a lot for Lance and I to talk about. We're flying without a net here on the editing. So it's going to be an interesting video today. All right, Lance. Well, look, markets have backed all-time highs. The bulls definitely fully in charge right now. What do you attribute the recent run to new highs in the market? Is it the return of buybacks? The market was looking for a catalyst. We got the CPI numbers, which, to be honest, they weren't terrible, but they weren't great either. But it seemed to be good enough that the market was able to use that as a reason to say, hey, no need to worry, we're getting those rate cuts we hope for. Mm-hmm. Is it those two things? Is it something else? What are you attributing it to?
No, that really is it. I mean, we got through earnings season, and you know, we've got almost $1 trillion worth of buybacks to complete by year end this year. So that's just a tremendous amount of buying power that's coming into the market. So again, it's interesting. You go back to, you know, October of last year, and we were writing about, you know, then we said a little bit more October weakness before the year-end rally, and the whole premise of that year-end rally was the reopening of the buyback window for year-end buybacks, get those on the books before the end of the year. And that led to that start of that rally that we had starting last October to present. And then, you know, back in, you and I discussed back in February and March, hey, markets are very overbought, they're extended, the buyback blackout window's coming, so expect a bit of a correction in the market, 5.5% decline. And then just a couple of weeks ago, we wrote that, hey, buyback window's about to open back up, you know, and that should help lift this market rally. And that coupled with that CPI report this week, which showed, again, as we've been kind of talking about, that rental component of CPI, which is one of the large, that's 44% of the entire CPI index, that homeowner's equivalent rent fell. And so there is that trend of weakening homeowner's equivalent rent is starting to show up in the data. And that's what gave both the markets and the Fed confidence. And if you listen to some of the recent speeches, Jerome Powell in particular last week, he said, inflation is a little bit stickier than we thought, but we still think we're on target for cutting rates and moving forward with easing accommodation. So, and by easing accommodation being, you know, reducing the amount of QT. So all that kind of played in here, gave the bulls really what they needed. Earnings season was fine. Wasn't a fantastic earnings season. We did beat estimates, but again, as always, yeah, we lower those estimates. But earnings were okay, particularly in the companies that matter. You know, Microsoft, Apple, Google, they all had decent earnings. Profit margins are sustained here. So again, really kind of the news is good. About 2 weeks ago, maybe a little bit more than 2 weeks ago, we posted this chart in our commentary, as well as you and I talked about this as well. We laid out these three pathways. And this was just as the market was challenging that initial 50-day moving average. So since then, you know, we've kind of followed, we said three paths. Path A is that we get above the 50-day, rally higher, you know, and we said at that time, we didn't say set new highs, we said re-challenge all-time highs in the market. Path B was a failure there, a retest of the 100, then the market rallies a bit. Pathway C was, you know, just kind of things fall apart and we go on down and test the 200-day moving average. So we ranked those in terms of probability, A being the highest possibility, B being the second probability, and C being the least likely. And A worked out to be the pathway that we kind of laid out. And as you can see, we kind of followed right along. You know, I just drew a straight line. I didn't like map it out, but the market actually kind of followed right along that pathway to re-challenge the previous highs. And then, of course, the news this week pushes through. And of course, as you break out to new highs, that brings in all of the buyers, right? So all the CTA programs, those computerized trading algorithms, the hedge funds, anybody that's doing programmatic trading, when you break out to new highs, that immediately creates inflows. Those buy programs kick in, and so you get additional buying. And that's why always there's these headlines that run around, Adam. It'll say, we set a new high today. Well, of course, you know, if the market was at an all-time high yesterday and it's up 0.1 point today, it's a new all-time high. So, yeah, you know, all-time highs are typically followed by more all-time highs. And that's because simply you've got a lot of momentum. Sentiment turns more bullish when that happens. And we're seeing that now with our sentiment indicators. Those are rising back towards more bullish extremes again. Markets are very, very overbought here short term. And I've got a couple of other charts we can look at about that. In fact, I wrote about it on Tuesday. We provide a risk range report in our weekly newsletter that basically just shows markets are all kind of pegged at this moment. So we're going to get a bit of a correction here. And what I mean a correction, a retest of the 50-day. And when that occurs, that'll be a good buying opportunity to add exposure to portfolios.
Okay. And that's sort of what I was going to ask, which is, should we get used to hearing, hey, new all-time high for a while here? Do you expect us to? Or are things so stretched, you think that you know, I remember you saying 2 weeks ago or so, I think that the model here had triggered a buy signal. Assuming it hasn't triggered a sell signal yet.
No. As you can see, we triggered that buy signal about 2 weeks ago. And we've been following through that. We're not extremely stretched, you know, so that buy signal has more to go. So there's more upside to this market. That doesn't necessarily mean it's going to go straight up, though. It could. I mean, there's nothing really stopping the market at this point, you know, in terms of money flows and positioning, that type of thing. So there's nothing really stopping the market from going higher here. But with the majority of your very short-term conditions very overbought, and you can kind of see that in these bottom two panels, stochastics as well as the relative strength Williams percent R. Sorry, these two indicators, these are really short-term indicators. They're just very overbought. They can stay overbought for a while. They have been overbought for a while, but typically that suggests you're going to get a little bit of a pullback. So, you know, what does that mean? Well, you come back and you re-challenge the breakout of the previous highs. If you fell there, you retest the 50-day moving average, which is about where the 20-day moving average is. Over the next, if this market kind of sustains itself over the next, you know, week or so or more, that 20 days is going to become the new support because it'll cross above the 50. And, you know, so you're going to have these levels. You've got several levels of support just below where the market is. Those are good entry opportunities at the moment to add exposure to your portfolio. If you've you know, gotten out of the market recently, or you're trying to figure out how to get, you know, back into the market, you know, that's what you're looking for. And as you can kind of see here, this red line is the 20-day moving average. It's right at the 50. So you're about to have a bullish cross of the 20 above the 50. That's going to give the market even more support. So you've got a cluster of two moving averages right here at the 50. When that crosses above it, that's a bullish signal. So we're going to have more bullish support for the market again, but that doesn't mean the market can't pull back here and give you a better entry point. So the point is be careful, you know, jumping into the market right here, you know, be a little bit patient. You'll get better prices to buy some of the things that you want to add to your portfolio.
Okay. Maybe in a sec too, Lance, if you could pull up the sector chart and just see if the market is continuing to broaden out. Because that would be a sign too that the market probably has the strength to continue powering higher, correct?
Yeah, and it has been broadening out. Utilities have been on fire lately, and we'll talk about you and I talked about utilities last week because we had talked about positions that we had added to the portfolio, and that was we added some utilities. We're adding some positions that play into artificial intelligence build out, right? The backbone of what supports artificial intelligence. So if you take a look at, you know, this kind of graphic over here, you know, technology's up and, you know, getting more overbought, but utilities right up there with it. And you know, if you go back to say October of last year, all these sectors were in this lower left-hand quadrant, which is oversold and really beaten up. Now everything's been migrating to the left, to the right, being overbought and not quite overbought yet. So some areas like communications, basic materials, they're not as overbought. Discretionary is the one thing that we'll talk about here in a minute. There's some warning signs in the discretionary sector, and that's been weakening. But the other areas like real estate, utilities, those are all have been improving a lot, particularly as interest rates have been coming down. Falling interest rates are great for utilities and great for real estate. So those have been performing better, but we are seeing a more broadening out. It's not just the Mag 7 anymore driving the market. We're now getting a broader spectrum of companies now supporting the rally, which is healthy, right? By the way.
Yeah. That's why I wanted to bring it up, because at the beginning of the year, for much of Q1, we talked about how the breadth was extremely narrow, and can't remember the exact stats, but I think it was sort of like the most narrow the market had traded since like mm-hmm. the 80s or something like that, right?
That's right, yeah.
And it was being brought up as a sign of, hey, this isn't a sign of a healthy market. And if these, you know, generals, these very few stocks that are leading the market start to stumble, they'll take everything down with it because the rest of the market was so weak. Now it seems like the market is strengthening with this broadening. And so, for those that are worried about a market correction, this is not necessarily the sign you would see if one were imminent, correct?
That's absolutely correct. And again, you know, there's a lot of things that, you and I talk a lot about, you know, different narratives that are out there, right? You know, this is, you know, commercial real estate and, you know, whether it's the dollar or, you know, just, you know, the debt, the deficit, you know, there's lots of real negative narratives out there. But, you know, the one thing, and I've got some charts to share with you in a minute, but, you know, the market is telling you that recession risk is not a big risk right now, right? That doesn't mean recession risk can't become an issue 6 months from now or 9 months from now. But the market is telling you right now the risk of a bigger downturn, an economic disaster of some sort, that's not a risk that you should be worrying about today.
Today, right. So a couple of things. One, I actually want to talk about some of those narratives in the time we have today. So I'll bring the conversation there at some point. Just because I've been hanging out with real investors over the past couple of days. And I really want us to both crawl into their brains.
Sure.
I do want to say real quick, the market is not very good about predicting recessions. When we go into a recession, stocks are usually partying going into them. So I just want to make sure.
That's not a true statement at all.
Is that not a true statement?
That is a very, very bad statement to make. And I'll prove it to you. Give me one second. Let me just get up. I actually just wrote an article on this.
Okay, because this is.
Of course,
this
I did, Adam. I knew what you were going to suggest.
I'm sure you did. And just to you know, not throw him under the bus, but this is what I've talked with Darius Dale about a lot, where it's like the party gets at its craziest right before the cops show up, right?
So there is a partial truth to that statement, which is markets do well before a recession. So take a look at this chart and let me see if I can make this a little bit bigger possibly. It's just so, because there's some important points about this chart. So can you see the blue dots on the chart, Adam?
Yep, I can see them.
Okay, so those are blue dots. And there's just interesting blue dots. Don't pay much attention to them. And of course you say, well, Lance, you know, those are at the peaks of the market. Right. And that's a true statement. Right. So prior to every peak of the market, we have this blue dot. Right. And then the market declines. Pay attention to those blue dots. We're going to come back to those blue dots in a second. So hold on for me. So let's take a look at market peaks versus GDP. So every market peak that's occurred since 1956, GDP was growing, with the exception of 1980. Right. GDP was growing on average at 2% or better. Now, within a very short period after that, you had a recession start, right? So we've had, GDP is 1.6 right now. It's expected to be, I forget what the Atlanta Fed latest is. I think it's 3.8. You can correct me if I'm wrong.
I'll pull it up while you're talking, so keep talking.
Okay, but I think the Atlanta Fed's sitting out at 3.5, 3.8, somewhere in there for the second quarter. So anyway, strong economic growth right now. Certainly, you know, in terms of your point, Adam, there's certainly no sign of a recession at the moment, but yet, you know, we have this conversation about it. Okay, so let's go back and look at the market versus recessions. And the yellow triangles is where the National Bureau of Economic Research dated the recession. And what's important about this is that the market declined well before, on average, about 6 to 16 months ahead of the actual dating of the recession. So in other words, we have a lot of recessionary indicators, and right now the market is doing just fine. When the market begins to decline in earnest, that's where most likely the market is starting to recognize that entrance into an economic recession. Why? And the reason is because earnings are declining. And right now earnings are growing, they're not declining. So once the economic environment hits a point to where you're getting a negative declination in earnings, the market will recognize that. And about 6 to 16 months later, the National Bureau of Economic Research will come out and say, oh yeah, that's where the recession started. And that's why it's always after the fact. But you'll note that the market always basically declines well before the recession is actually recognized.
Well, so help me understand this then. So let's look at that last one that you were just on. So the yellow triangle is the dating. Is that when they're saying it started, or is that when they declared their dates for the recession?
That's why they declare it. And see, this is the problem with looking at markets versus recessions, right? So if you just take off those yellow dots at the moment and just say, okay, let's just overlay the market with recessions, you can say, well, the market's a terrible predictor of recessions because you can see they're coincident, right?
Right.
Well, the problem is we didn't know we were in a recession at the time until 6 to 16 months later. They came out and said, oh, the recession started a year ago, back in 2000. As a good example of this is December of 2007 was the start of the recession. We didn't know until December of 2008. But the market was declining before Lehman ever occurred. That's where the bulk of the, if you look at 2008, the market was declining. There was no consensus of a recession. Everybody's fine. We're just in a correction. That's all it is, just a correction in a market. And then Lehman, almost 50% of the entire decline, I'm sorry, almost 60% of the entire decline of 2008 occurred following September the 18th, when Lehman was forced into bankruptcy.
Right.
But the market was already well aware that something wasn't right. And then of course, in December, they come out and say, oh yeah, there was a recession that started a year ago. So the point is that the market is a good leading indicator of recessions if you pay attention to it. And right now the market's saying, hey, there's not a risk of recession. Earnings are growing. Economic growth is fine. And again, economic growth isn't a great predictor either because of the revisions. But the market's looking at the data. And this is the one thing that, I was talking a lot about this week on our radio show, which, by the way, we're in our studio. That's why it looks different. But this is the one thing that I was talking a lot about this week is that, you know, you and I, you know, we're sitting here debating this. And everybody listening to this interview right now, we all have our own opinions. And, you know, you have your opinion. I have my opinion. Darius Dell has his opinion. And those are all opinions, right? But we're all acting on those in the market. So you think about the stock market, right? You have buyers and sellers, millions of them, all acting on the same set of data. And we're all making decisions on this data, trying to assume what's going to happen next. So in other words, I'm looking at the market saying, okay, this market is this massive organic organism of very smart people. I mean, now we're talking about every major investor from Ray Dalio to Warren Buffett to everybody else, all making decisions about the market based on the same sets of data. And what the market is a representation of is that compilation of all that computing power and mind power all around the world investing in the markets. So if you're trying to fight that, you're trying to say that my opinion is better than millions of people all acting in the market at one time. And that's a tough argument to make.
It is a tough argument. And that's what we say, if you're going to place bearish trades, you have to be, your timing has to be great. You kind of have to be lucky, to be real honest, but you're really bucking the trend. And look, I mean, contrarians can make a ton of money, but it's very hard to do and do well. And if you're not Warren Buffett or Ray Dalio or a famous, you know, short seller. Oh God, blanking on the guy's name. I'll remember it as soon as we finish this. But anyways, unless you're one of those guys, your odds of beating, you know, the collective computational power that you're talking about, it is pretty low. So you just got to you got to know that going in. Let me, before we go to this chart, just go back to the other chart just for 1 second, because I want to restate what you said and see if you agree with me. Which is, you would say, based on history, when the market is in an uptrend, very highly unlikely that a recession that we will feel is a recession. It won't be an academic debate. We'll just look around and say, okay, yeah, we're all in a recession now. Highly unlikely that's going to happen quickly after an all-time high in the market, that you would expect to see some market weakness, some period of market weakness before we're at a point in the economy where we all agree times are bad.
Yeah. And again, now I wanted to clarify a couple of things, because we've had some anomalies over the last few years that certainly, and again, nothing's ever a perfect indicator, right? So what I want to say is that just because I'm making this case to pay attention to what the market's saying doesn't mean that it's going to be right 100% of the time. No indicator is, right? There's nothing that's perfect. Leading indicators are wrong this time, right? Leading indicators have been negative for ever now, right? Yield curves have been negative the longest on record ever, and there's no recession. Doesn't mean they're wrong, right? It just means that there are other dynamics at play in the market, which is keeping things from occurring like they did normally. And a good example of that, going to this table. So what this table is, this looks at the date of the market peak, the market peak at the market price at the peak, when the recession started. So let's just take the first row at the top, and I'll walk through it with you real quick, just so we have it. July 1st, 1956 was the market peak, peaked at 48. It's hard to imagine. The index is at 48. We're now at 5,300.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, right. So 2 months later, the recession started, okay? Recession, now this was according to the market data, right? The market lead of the recession was 14 months because it wasn't dated till 14 months later. Now, the National Bureau of Economic Research didn't actually start dating recessions until 1980. So prior to 1979, there's no official dating of recessions. So, and this is important because once the National Bureau of Economics started dating recessions, you can see this big drop between the lead time between the markets and the actual dating of the recession. And what that means is that the National Bureau of Economic Research dated that recession within a month or so of it actually starting. Mm-hmm. But it was well after the fact, right? So it was 6 to 16 months later, they got it within a month or two. So 1980, they said it was 6 months later, right? And they said it started the same month that it actually started. So their pinpointing of the recession start was pretty accurate, but it was 6 months later. So if we take a look at 1990 as an example, or let's say the 2000 recession. So August 1st of 2000, the market peaked. It was recognized that it occurred on 11/26/2001, which was 9 months after the fact, but that was 7 months later than what the market recognized. Now, if you go to the financial crisis, the market peaked on October the 1st of 2007. It was within 2 months, because it was December, that it actually was recognized, but it was 12 months after the fact, right? So of course, 2020, the market peaked in February, the recession started in March, and it was recognized 16 months later. So the MBR has trimmed down the accuracy of where that recession actually started, but the market recognized it well before the National Bureau of Economic Research did. And that's the real takeaway, is that the market's a better predictor of these turns of economic dynamics better than, you know, a group of economists sitting around trying to figure out when it actually started and waiting for the revisions. And remember, the National Bureau of Economic Research has to wait for all the data to be revised.
Right.
Before they make that announcement.
Right. So again, just to sort of restate what you're saying, the market does a better job of sniffing out trouble. A little TBD about how, what the timeline that is. It looks like it's somewhere between, you know, 0 to 8 months. Let's just cut the difference and say maybe three-ish months or so on average, three and a half. And so to your point, when the markets are in an uptrend, especially if they're hitting new highs, highly unlikely that a recession is going to like literally arrive tomorrow. And so you'd want to see some downward momentum in the market before you'd start entertaining the fact that, like, yeah, we might be on a trajectory to recession in the near future.
Yeah. And that's the important point, right, Adam? So, you know, is that there's a difference between a correction and a bear market.
Sure.
Right. So, you know, the sell-off in April, that was a correction. We came down, you said, and you could go back to April and say, okay, the market just peaked and we're now at all-time highs and now it's correcting. So it's recognizing the recession starting. But again, it was the correction only lasted for a couple of weeks. Then the market, you know, bounced and started rallying, made new highs. So that negates that. You're going to have to wait a bit for the market to begin to fail. And that's the big point, right? You're looking for where the market begins to fail. So in other words, you start getting a series of lower highs. You start getting a series of lower lows and you're starting to trend a lot lower. I haven't updated this bottom line on this table is from the peak of the market 1/1/22. Obviously, you know, at that point, the market peaked and it looked like we were going into a recession and a bear market. The market was down 20%. But again, we rallied in October. So that never occurred, right? So there's never been a recognition of the recession. The market didn't recognize the recession, although it looked like it was going to. Mm-hmm. It changed its view based on monetary accommodation. Earnings started to improve. Economic growth started to pick up. So again, that negated that whole thing. So now we've got to reset this table and say, okay, where's the next market peak? And then we'll begin that countdown again.
Okay. So I think this has been a really instructive discussion because for the people who are understandably, you know, concerned about valuations and a lot of the other things that we talk about, you know, you're basically saying, look, you really don't want to, I mean, sure, play defense if that's what makes you sleep at night, but you don't want to, you know, put yourself in the position where you're taking all your chips off the table when all the indicators are green like this. You're saying we're going to get some advance warning of potential trouble in the market. And so to the extent that the game is raging and the momentum is there in the market like it is right now, you can have some confidence that you can continue to play that. And I hate to use this analogy, but it sort of applies, which is the Chuck Prinz, you know, while the music's playing, you know, you should be out there dancing on the dance floor. Maybe you're going to be standing next to the exit, but you know, if you want to be growing your wealth, we don't seem to see the conditions right now that say you'll want to be off the dance floor entirely.
Yep. Now, again, that doesn't mean we're not going to have short-term corrections. So this is the table I was telling you about a second ago. So every week in our bull bear report that we produce on the weekends, towards the bottom, we have a bunch of tables on market statistics, fear greed gauge, technical analysis of the markets, but we produce this one table. This is our risk range report. And so what this shows you is the price performance of major markets and sectors over the last 52 weeks, 24 weeks, 12 weeks, 4 weeks, 1 week. That's this first left colored column. And what that's showing you is that prices in these sectors and markets, are they improving? Are they getting stronger? Are they getting weaker? Right. And so if you look back over the last 52 weeks, they were all very red. Since then, they've become much better, right? Even bonds have been improving in terms of price performance. Then if we move further to the right, we have this risk range, which is where all these reds, now this is from the report 2 weeks ago. What these two columns, what the risk range analyzes is that in a given month, so in the month of May, right, is the S&P index trading outside of its normal risk parameters based on historical beta volatility and price movement? So let's say that on average, you know, we look back over history and the S&P 500 trades within a 2% range in a given month. It might be up 2% or it might be down 2% in a given month on average. Doesn't mean you can't have a bigger month, but on average, it trades between 2% positive, 2% negative. So as of now, or this was as of 2 weeks ago, the S&P was trading outside of that normal risk range for the month of May. So it's overbought short term, meaning that you're probably going to get some type of short term corrective action to relieve some of that overbought condition. Now, moving to the right, this becomes much more important. This is a short term weekly moving average and a long term moving average. And that's these two columns kind of over here where it says short WMA, long WMA. So those are the short weekly moving averages, long-term weekly moving average of the S&P, which is our relative index. So all these other sectors are comparing relative to the S&P. So if these two columns over here show the percentage deviation above those moving averages. So when you start getting double-digit deviations above those moving averages, that's normally where you're going to get some type of corrective action, right? And so you're going to see this market pull back at some point, a corrective action. Now, the question, though, is do we need to be worrying about this just being a correction or something faulting into a much bigger market decline? That goes to this last column. When you have weekly moving averages crossing bullish, and right now we have every sector and market, bonds, gold, small cap, mid cap, equal weights, dividends, every major sector of the market, they're all on bullish buy signals. So when you have
except for the dollar, and a weakening dollar tends to be bullish for everything else.
Correct, right? So it running contrary is not really that big of a surprise. But the point is that when you have every major bullish sector positive, the odds are that there's not a risk to the market of going lower because everything is moving in a positive direction. Lots of momentum, lots of sentiment. Now, this is the example I laid out. I just kind of put some stuff up here. Let's go back in history for a moment, and let's look at the market in October 1st of 2022, right? So this is where the markets were declining all through the summer. I'm gonna come back to this chart in a second. So this is where the markets are declining. We've been in a negative trending market from January all the way through October. And we had very negative sentiment on investors. And this is where you and I were talking about at that time, hey, you know, we're going to start to see this market rally because you've got, you know, very negative sentiment. That's a good setup. That's a great buy signal for markets. Everything was super negative. You'll notice that every sector except the dollar and at that particular time, utilities were on negative bearish sell signals, which suggests that price pressure was lower, not higher. Also, look at the deviation below the long-term moving averages were running double digits. So again, extremely negative sentiment, extreme deviations from long-term trends, very bearish signals. That was a great setup for this market to start to find a bottom. And of course, that's what we did. Again, if we take a look at sentiment, we had some of the lowest sentiment levels in terms of allocation and sentiment that we'd had since the financial crisis and other major market bottoms. So again, every reason was there to understand that. Now, and if we go back and if I pull, we produce this every week and I keep a record of this. So I can go back and pull every single week going back to January 1st of 2022. And at the beginning of January 2022, most of those signals were bullish buy, right? Everything was green, just kind of like it is now. And then over the course of the next few months, heading into March, more and more of them started becoming red. And you started getting more and more bearish crossovers to the downside, suggesting that we were moving more from just a really short-term correction to a bigger downtrend in the market. And that was why we were reducing equity risk at that time, reducing our exposure to raising our cash levels in portfolios, because we were seeing that deterioration in the markets. So again, if we come back to look at where we are today, you know, again, very, very bullish, everything is fine. And what we wanna be looking for here is to determine, are we moving just from a normalized correction? Again, this deviation short-term is going to lead to a correction at some point, maybe a month from now, maybe 2 months from now, but we're going to get, you know, a retest of the 50-day moving average, whatever it is. But we want to watch these bullish crossovers. If we begin to start to see more of these signals top up bearish, that's going to tell us that, hey, this is a little, there's some weakening going on in the markets we need to be paying much more attention to, becoming a little bit better risk managers, maybe raising some cash. We just don't have any of those signals. I would expect, and this is something we can talk about in a second, that discretionary is going to be one of the first signals that we see pop up and turn bearish.
I would agree with you on that. Let me just ask a naive question, but I'm guessing some other folks are thinking of it. Go back to the one from October 2022.
Yes.
And while you're pulling it up, I should have said this at the beginning of the video, and folks, I apologize, I didn't. Lance, a lot of folks have been saying, hey, you know, are you going to give the Simplevisor overview this weekend? We're all dying for it, right? I don't think we're quite there yet, folks. So even though you're seeing a lot of the amazing, you know, bells and whistles and benefits of the Simplevisor platform, it's not going to be this week, right, Lance?
Yeah. Well, hey, you don't have time today. You're on a short schedule. And as I've said over the last couple of weeks, we just submitted all of the portfolio models to our data providers. And because when we roll this out, not only will people using Simplevisor have access to the models that we run for our clients, we will also have 8 additional models that cover everything from infrastructure to artificial intelligence to cryptocurrency to an all-weather type portfolio. And I have one slot allocated for you, Adam, for your Thoughtful Money portfolio. Plus, we just built an accumulator model as well that we just submitted for people that are just getting started into the vesting process. So I'm getting all those models built. So when we roll this out, give me another week or so. But when I get all these models up and allocated and ready to roll, then we can also walk through how you can open an account and select and use one of these models for your own portfolio.
Okay, great. Yeah, so folks, another week or two, you know, I'm just as excited as you all are. Yeah.
Excited too. Just give me another. I just want to, when we roll it out, I just want to make sure all the tools are there for you.
Okay. So looking at this chart, and I mean, I remember talking with you back in October 2022. Yes, I think, you know, you were saying, look, things are looking so compressed to the downside that it wouldn't be a surprise to see, you know, some sort of recovery. I to be super clear, I don't think we were talking about the kind of, you know, face ripping year and a half long recovery that we've had.
No, nobody expected that one.
Yeah, nobody expected that. But you, you know, you were saying, you're saying here, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, hey, this is like a great setup, right? Because bull markets climb a wall of worry. That's your wall of worry right there, right? Everything bearish, everything deviated from its long-term averages. The chart today looks pretty opposite. And I know that's why you're saying, hey, expect some sort of correction. But, and I'm not, I know you're not saying this, but let's say we did get a pretty substantial market drop from here. You would probably be looking at this and saying, yeah, I can believe it because this is a pretty overextended bull run given the data here.
Right. But again, this is week. So very important, right? This is weekly data. So it's slower. Right. So, you know, if you take the problem with daily data, if you're looking at the market every day, the reason that people are terrible investors is that they look at the market every day and they're making kind of knee jerk reactions based on what happens from one day to the next. If you slow things down and look on a weekly basis, you'll make much better investment decisions because it gets rid of some of that volatility.
Right.
And so what's important about this analysis is because it's weekly and because it's longer term in nature, what you're looking for is for all these bullish signals to begin to reverse. It doesn't mean you wait until they're all red like they are, you know, in the other chart of October, right? You don't wait for that to say, oh, now I'm getting out of the market. What you're looking for is for major sectors to begin to turn negative. And again, we're watching what's happening with the consumer right now. There's definitely a deterioration in discretionary spending. In fact, we reduced some of our discretionary holdings this past week because of this. So I'm expecting that we're going to see some further deterioration in discretionary over the next few months. If I'm right, that's going to be the first signal in the S&P to trigger a bearish crossover. If it does, then that suggests that the consumer is slowing down, and we then may see another, we may see staples begin to weaken a bit, you know, or some other sector, maybe it's industrials or maybe it's energy as consumers slow down. And we see those crossovers. And so as you begin to see more of these crossovers, that's your signal that the market is really beginning to deteriorate. And the main market may be doing just fine, right? So if you're just looking at the S&P, you may not catch this, but underneath the surface, what you're looking for is those supports to erode. And right now we don't have any erosion of support. So there's no concern about anything other than just a short-term, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5% correction, could be as much as 10, could have a 10% correction, completely normal in any given year. But nothing greater than that right now. Again, when we get to September, October, prior to the election, expect a 5 to 10% correction. That's historically what happens because nobody wants to be long going into a presidential election. And I can't imagine with this election this year that anybody wants to be really long going into that election, just because you don't know what's going to happen. Post that, you know, markets will probably rally. But again, you know, there is a risk that we're going to have another 5 to 10% correction sometime this summer, probably closer to the election. But again, as long as these major sectors are on bullish buys, that's all it's going to be. It'll be just a correction. And again, so I took those signals and I plotted them over the S&P. And so if you go back in history and look at when that short-term moving average crosses below the long-term moving average, that's been a great risk reduction model. So when you begin to see that flip over, that's a great time to start reducing risk. Does it work 100% of the time? No. Are there times where you get whipsawed in and out of the market? Yes, it can occur. But more often than not, it's going to help you reduce risk ahead of time and avoid those bigger drawdowns in the market. The only time it didn't work was 2020, because again, this is weekly data. And the entire collapse of the market occurred in 3 weeks in the month of March. So by the time that a weekly indicator could catch up with the 3 week move, it was already over.
Yeah, so I think it's fair to say 2020 was a complete aberration. Like, take that out of the data set. Yeah.
Right. But outside of that, it's not a good job of helping you navigate downturns in the market. Just to reduce risk, it doesn't mean get out of the market, short the market, you know, head for the hills. There's been times it's been good for that. But more often than not, if you just kind of pay attention to just some type of market-related signal that you slow down a little bit, you're not going to catch the top. You're not going to sell right. You're not going to sell right at the top. You're not going to buy right at the bottom. You're going to be late on both ends. But you know, again, you know, maybe you're down 5 or 6% from the peak, but you avoid the other 15% of the decline, you know, through a downturn in the market. So again, these are just better ways to manage money rather than just emotional biases.
Yeah, no, I really like this indicator. And I actually want us to start bringing it up on a weekly basis, at least when we're at extremes, because it seems like it's really helpful in identifying turning points early. Now, to your point, you're going to identify the turning point after it's happened, but hopefully relatively soon after it's happened, so you can then avoid the rest of the momentum, right?
And again, you know,
I'm kind of wondering why you didn't pull this up, you know, years ago, buddy.
Because I just built it 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
No. These moving averages are part and parcel of how we manage money in the house. We watch these very closely. And even in SimpleVisor, we've actually recreated part of that analysis in our money flow indicators. And so we have a money flow indicator that we actually run that you can actually run on SimpleVisor itself and run those strategies to show you kind of how that works. And so this is the actual model itself running. So you can actually run these kind of weekly models on a real-time basis. This is for Apple. But, you know, basically I can, you know, change it to, you know, spiders. You can take a look at it in terms of the spider indicator.
All right. Very cool. I know people are salivating now wanting the full walk through this thing. All right. I've got four things I want to get through before we wrap things up here. Yep. And we're beginning to get tight on time, just given the unique nature of today's video.
Yep.
Actually, and real quick before I do them, two additions. One, I did look up the Atlanta Fed GDP now. It's currently at 3.6, so it's still pretty elevated for GDP growth for Q2. It is down from 3.8 prior reading. The short seller, whose name I couldn't remember, is Jim Chanos, the famous short seller. I just didn't want Jim to think I'd forgotten about him.
yeah, I don't want to upset anybody.
okay, and so... you know, basically looking at the markets right now, they're saying everything's great. Don't worry about recession. You know, likely to see probably higher highs from here, at least in the very near term. I was interviewing Jan Van Eck yesterday. So his firm, Van Eck, they have like over $100 billion in ETFs and funds that they manage. And I'm sure most people watching are familiar with Van Eck funds, even if they don't know it. Good example is GDX, the big mining fund. That's a Van Eck fund. They've got the biggest semiconductor fund. They're just the visibility into a huge swath of the global economy. And he was actually relatively bullish right now. I mean, definitely areas of concern for us to talk about. But two things that he noted, I just wanted to share. One is... one of the things that's really caught his eye recently is that by measuring using the PMIs, global growth is back into positive territory. And that's the first time in 2 years. And he thinks that should not be discounted. He very much is looking at the growth that's coming out of Asia right now. China, you know, seems to be picking itself up off the floor. India is just a crazy powerhouse right now. And you know, I'd kind of known that, but he had some stats about India that just blew my mind. And maybe that's something at some point, Lance, we could talk about in a future video, just in terms of what looks to be like a secular rise of the Indian economy over the next decade. So anyways, just wanted to note that you know, the rest of the world, you know, the U.S. has been the cleanest dirty shirt or whatever analogy folks want to use for the past couple of years, as the rest of the world has really fallen into recession or at least stagnation. That now seems to be changing. And so that will be positive, net positive in the global economy. We talked a little bit about AI, and he pulled a figure out that I guess in the next, I don't know, couple of years, there's projected to be $10 trillion worth of capital CapEx spent on just data centers. And he said, you know, and that estimate is now maybe looking to be a little bit low, right? So there's just a phenomenal amount of spending that's going on in that space.
Right. And there's actually I was just having this conversation this morning with my investment team. You know, so we talked about over the last couple of shows with you that we've been, you know, kind of remodeling our portfolio a little bit. We added some positions. We've owned Duke Energy for a very long time. And the dividend model, we added American Electric Power. And if you take a look, and Van Eck's right? We're going to spend hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars, building out data centers and all this stuff because that's what's required. Problem is, you got to power all that. Yep. So there's, and so this is a really interesting point, especially for people that are going, you know, oh, the debts, the deficits, and, you know, this is going to be the end of the economy. When you start looking at the amount of build out of the electric grid that we've got to do, it's astronomical. Our electric grid's outdated to start with. It's got to be upgraded and increased in order to support not just the electricity demands of AI data centers, right? But everybody wants to drive an electric vehicle. Everybody's getting more and more, you know, smartphones, computers. Everything we're doing is adding to that demand for electricity. And solar power is great, it's not efficient. Wind power is great, it's not that efficient. We're gonna have to go back to looking at nuclear and natural gas for generating the electricity that we need in quantity that we need to support all this other stuff that we're gonna do. That's a huge economic benefit. That is productive investment, massive amounts of CapEx, debt that'll be issued. Corporations will issue debt to do build out. The government is likely to get involved in issuing debt to do build out. That's a productive use of debt. So very importantly, when you look at the debt, you have to say, is that debt productive or not productive, right? So debt that we issue to send stimulus payments to households, not productive, right? Bad debt. Good debt is debt that is used to do economic expansion that creates jobs, it creates demand for activity within the economy, things like copper and wiring and everything else involved, concrete, lumber, everything else, but also create those jobs, also create salaries for people to spend within the economy. So you're talking about the ability for something to potentially have a very positive side effect of creating economic growth over the next decade that wasn't really built into the models over the last decade because we didn't really kind of get that far in our thought process.
Yeah. And you're now kind of going perhaps into the last thing I want to talk about here, but we'll get there. Yep. That's a big reason why copper is kind of, you know, shooting the moon right now. Yep. Right. Because people are waking up to this, right. And it's why utilities, this sleepy, boring sector, is all of a sudden now trading like a growth sector. So we're ticking off the fact that there are these things here that are actually, you know, secular growth catalysts. This may not be a secular catalyst, but on the morning we're talking here, China just announced that a $42 billion stimulus that it's going to give state entities to go out and buy distressed real estate in China. Mm-hmm. So, even that, whether you think that's a good idea or a bad idea, it looks like it is happening. That is going to be stimulative, should be stimulative to the Chinese economy and perhaps then the global economy, because their real estate market has been basically an anchor around their neck. And if this, TBD, whether this is enough to turn the tide, but if it is, that could have a material positive effect as well on the global economy. So, you know, it's just a reminder that whatever narrative you're wed to, you got to keep an eye on the implications of some of these decisions that are getting made, right? Because these are real things. All right, real quick, probably don't have a ton of time to do it justice, but you mentioned a couple of times that you think consumer discretionary may be the first sector to start to stumble here. What specifically is making you think that?
Well, we saw retail sales obviously was the first one. The recent retail sales report came in at zero. And of course, you know, we look back at the previous 2 months. Remember, you and I talked about this, we were on a conversation and you're like, hey, the retail sales came in really strong. I was like, hold on a second. You got to look at what was going on. First of all, February was strong, but that was, Valentine's Day. And then March was strong, but it was actually weaker than February. And you had both spring break and Easter. Easter got pulled forward. So it wasn't really as strong as what headlines suggested. Well, both of those numbers were revised sharply lower. So they were even worse than what we thought initially. So we are definitely seeing some deterioration in the consumer. And that's starting to get picked up by discretionary companies. Walmart just had stellar earnings. We own Walmart in our portfolio and had just a great earnings report. But they made some interesting statements. They said, first of all, we're seeing consumers step down, right, and coming in. So Walmart sells groceries, and that's a big chunk of their business. Target does also, by the way. But Walmart has a big component of their sales that comes out of groceries. So if you're used to shopping at whole paycheck, it's not surprising to see people now step down to go shop at Walmart because they can save money. And, you know, they can buy some off-brand items, to reduce their costs. So so Walmart said they're seeing that change. So that's
when you said whole paycheck, you meant Whole Foods, right?
Yeah, of course. That's whole paycheck. I don't know what y'all refer to in California. Take a minute to make that connection. Okay. Yeah. But they're seeing consumers step down. They're also, we're also seeing a trend within consumption in terms of eating out, those type of things. So we're seeing that impact of this higher food cost and just higher cost of living in general, that wage growth has not kept up with the cost of living, beginning to enter into some of these discretionary stocks. So, like, for instance, our portfolio, we own Genuine Auto Parts and Amazon. We sold Genuine Auto Parts because it's very impacted by consumer spending. We also sold half of our Visa position because Visa collects fees on consumer transactions, right? So every time you swipe your Visa card, they get a fee for that. So fewer transactions, less revenue. So we reduced that position by half in our portfolio. So we sold half of our position in Visa because they're very directly impacted by transactional fees from consumers. We did not reduce our position in Amazon, however, because even though it is technically a cyclical discretionary stock, nobody really looks at Amazon for the discretionary cyclical space. They look at it for AWS, their data centers, and artificial intelligence. So we kept that position and reduced the other discretionary positions in our portfolio.
Okay. Yep. All right. It's funny. It's interesting. It sounds like you're saying that we're seeing this effect on the consumer, that they're beginning to buckle after this long time period of being weighed down by, you know, higher costs of living, higher costs of debt. It's almost like it's happening with some sort of lag, like an effect that happens with a lag. It's interesting.
Yeah, that pig in the python that we're not supposed to talk about anymore.
All right. Okay, so this is a good transition into the last part here, and we don't have as much time as I think I'd like to talk about this, but we'll do it anyways. So as I mentioned, I've been at a few events where people who watch Thoughtful Money have shown up, and we've had some wonderful conversations, and I've done Q&A with them. And the thing that's really sort of standing out to me is that very intelligent people. They take very good notes on the interviews that are on this channel and on these weekly market recaps with you, Lance. And they get the I think very valuable balance that you bring when you say, "Hey, look, don't let a narrative just force you into the bunker, right?" We have to trade the markets that we have, not as we wish they would be. They're multifactorial. There's lots of things that, you know, can continue the momentum and the status quo for a lot longer than certain headlines might suggest. And therefore, you know, you want to take the type of approach that you're talking about. And I think they get all that. What I did take away from them, though, was a general sense of, if I had to like summarize their position, I would say it's concerned and it's distrustful. And what I mean by that is like, I'm just mentioning a couple of things. They look at the mounting debt that's going on in the country right now, combined with now the high cost of debt. And they just think, look, yes, maybe some of this is productive. Maybe we're going to get some benefit at some point in the future of some of this stuff. But like, this just can't continue forever, right? We can't continue spending at these levels forever with no consequences, right? But we seem to be acting like we are. They look at the, you know, 20 to 30% increase in the cost of living since before the pandemic. And they're just saying, look, we've just basically taken, you know, a cannon shot and now we're just sort of being told to walk it off, right? And inflation's still not fully under control. And we just don't have confidence that things are going to be improving on that side anytime soon. Yeah, the beatings might become less, but there's not going to be a day where we don't see great odds of a day where we feel like things are becoming more affordable again, right? They look at the jobs market and say, look, we're being told how awesome the jobs market is, but to us real people, it is not feeling that way. In fact, we feel kind of nervous about our jobs in the short term. But as we all talk about AI, like, we can see that companies are investing in automation and software hand over fist, and that, you know, we look in the future and we see there's going to be less jobs for people, yeah, right?
Absolutely.
So they look at corporate America and they say, you know what, there's a smaller and smaller number of bigger and bigger companies that are just taking over everything. And it's kind of a winner take all, you know, environment there. And our robust, diversified, you know, business landscape is really getting captured by these big guys. And then we're just, you know, they decide to raise prices, there's really nothing we can do, right? So it's not a fearful bunker, the world is ending type of thing. It's just a general sense of, like, you know, we're just looking at the trajectory of the world around us, and it seems to be headed in either unsustainable directions or directions that just look like our prospects are going to get worse from here. And yet we're kind of being told, don't worry, you know, or it's all going to be better, or, you know, what's happening right now. This is not a partisan comment, but there's a lot of articles recently about how the administration is sort of trying to spin where inflation was when it came into office, and that things are actually really good now. Inflation's in a much better place. And people are like, what the hell are you talking about? Like, it cost me a fortune to go to the grocery store.
Right. So, but here's the issue, right? Which is, what's our job here? Right. So yes, let's take all that narrative you just laid out there. Right. So
yeah, sorry. Let me say one thing and I'll let you go, which is,
okay, yeah.
I'm not saying these people necessarily are right or wrong. I will say I completely identify and understand, sure, how they feel.
So
my question to you, and maybe you're answering it, is, you know, how do you as a capital manager say, okay, how do you speak to that person? I guess is right. What I want to say.
And so that's what I was going to say is, like, okay. So first of all, you know, you and I agree. Look, I just wrote an article for today. I just posted it on our website.
Shocked am I?
I know you're shocked and amazed, but, you know, so again, you know, everybody says, Lance, you're always so bullish, blah, blah, blah. I'm really not, right? You know, I'm just analyzing data for what it is. So, but what this article addresses is Buffett's cash hoard that he has on his balance sheet. And it says, is it a warning, right, for the markets? And if you take a look at Warren Buffett, I'm going to answer your question. So just bear with me real quick.
Don't worry. I'm trusting you.
Yeah, but so you take a look at Berkshire. He has $189 billion in cash. It'll be $200 billion by this next quarter when he reports, right? Right now, his cash hoard, if you converted that to GDP, he would be basically larger than Ukraine. He would be just behind Hungary so by the end of next quarter. So he's as big as an entire country all by himself, right? But here's what he said that was, and this is inflation-adjusted market cap to GDP. Currently, we're trading at 2x the market value of what GDP says. So in other words, corporations are a function of economic growth. Their growth comes from the economy, right? That's where their earnings come from. It's our economic activity. So companies are trading at 2x that valuation currently. So very overvalued. So what did Warren Buffett recently say? This is his words, right? And so I'll go through a bunch of data. You can read the article about market cap GDP, why it's important. But here's what he said. This is a snippet from his actual quarterly report. Now, nobody reported on this, but it was sitting right there in front of everybody. Occasionally, markets and or the economy will cause stocks and bonds of some large and fundamentally sound businesses to be strikingly mispriced. Indeed, markets can and will unpredictably seize up or vanish as they did for months in 1914 and a few days in 2001. If you believe American investors are now more stable in the past, think back to September of 2008. Such instant panics won't happen often, but they do happen. And so when you start looking at what's going on in terms of valuation of the market, all those narratives that you just posted out there, right? Those all certainly are important. But what we have to look at is, what is our role? So if my role is simply to just worry about all these things, then you can sit home and worry about these things and kind of be miserable, right? Because they're terrible things. But if my job or if my role is to make money and grow my wealth despite all of those things. And so this is where we've got to really separate ourselves from all these different topics. Is debt to GDP high in the economy? Yes, it is. We're currently about 120, I haven't looked at it lately, but like 123% of debt to GDP. Japan is 280% of debt to GDP. So is debt to GDP high in the US? Yes. Can it get a lot higher? Absolutely. Japan is a great track record of what you can do with debt to GDP ratios. But the consequence of that is also we can grow our way out of it. So if all of this artificial intelligence, the build out of utilities, everything else that we're doing comes to fruition, then GDP will grow at a faster pace than the debt. And so, yes, we will still have a high debt to GDP ratio. Yes, but we can begin to grow our way out of it somewhat over time. But it doesn't mean necessarily that the world just comes to an end. Yes, when you take a look at the nominal debt of our spending, it certainly seems high. But when you're spending money, you also have to look at it in terms of debt to GDP, which is a very important analysis of, you know, what we're doing with that debt and how we're growing it. And really, what's the relationship? Deficits are the same way. You should look at deficit to GDP versus just the raw deficit. So you have to put some of these things into context. And when you do, you start to see a little bit of a different picture emerge than what a lot of these headlines suggest, which is that, yes, we're in a bad position, but it's not as dire as some of these other headlines suggest. So taking that statement, what's our job with this? So we have two jobs. We can just sit here and worry about it and do nothing. Or we can say, I understand what that data is. Now, what can I do to better my position? So no matter what happens with that data, I'm better off, right? So I can do that by making money in the financial markets. I can invest and grow my assets because markets are growing right now. And I can improve my wealth position relative to everybody else. I can improve my position in life by learning skill sets that are going to not be automatically replaced by AI, as an example. Yes, AI is going to replace tons of jobs. I was just talking to Brent earlier this week, and you know this, Adam, with YouTube in particular, you can't play music on YouTube because you'll immediately get copyrighted and they'll shut off your feed, right? Well, there you can go to a website called Murph.ai, and basically you write your lyrics and you tell the AI program what style of artist you want, male or female. What type of music do you want? Rock, jazz, country rock, pop, whatever it is. What type of instrumentation you want? And within about 30 seconds, it'll take your lyrics and write a song for you. And it's good. These are really, really good songs with a good beat, good lyrics. If you write good lyrics, you'll get a good song out of it. And it just goes to show you that musicians are not safe from AI. It won't take much to replace Taylor Swift with an artificial version of Taylor Swift and make good music. So the point is that no job, artist jobs aren't safe. I use, you know, if you take a look at, the graphics on our website, I have Warren Buffett today sitting on top of a pile of cash. I did that in Midjourney in about 2 minutes with AI and created my own graphic. So I don't really need an artist anymore. I used to pay for graphics. I used to go to places that provided stock photography, and I would pay them for their stock. I don't need to do that anymore. So no job is safe from AI. And that is certainly going to weigh on the economy. But again, we don't look, when you talk about employment as a good example, we don't look at employment in terms of, is employment healthy, right? We don't talk about the employment health. We talk about how many people are unemployed versus those that have jobs. Well, if you're unemployed for a while, we no longer count you, right? So we've got 110 million people that we just don't count anymore. We just say, well, they decided to stay home. They're, you know, that's, you know, people, you know, housewives or house husbands taking care of kids. They're no longer in the labor force. So people are just going to fall off the rolls. We'll still have great employment numbers, but the wealth of that side of society is not going to be great. This all leads to lower wealth for the average American. This all leads to lower economic prosperity for the average American. Our job is to understand that, take advantage of the opportunities we have, and grow wealth for ourselves in this environment, no matter what it is. We have to grow wealth and get ourselves into a position that we're not in that group. We want to be in the other group that is doing okay and has money and has wealth. We can make those decisions to better ourselves, or we can make decisions not to participate in the markets because we're worried about an eventual crash that will happen. We will have another crash at some point, could be 10 years from now. I can sit and do nothing and wait for that. And I can pound my chest 10 years from now and say, hey, I avoided the crash, but I'm going to be in this group of people over here that have no money, no prospects, no economic wealth to speak of, and have to suffer that trend. Or I can take advantage of this, create myself a better position, and just understand that I can avoid that risk of a downturn when it occurs by paying attention to the data, which you and I do every week.
So let me restate what you're saying, because I very much agree with everything, which is I think at any point in our respective careers, we would have said, look, financial literacy is important and taking charge of your financial destiny is important. You should do it. It should be a priority of yours. But what I hear you saying, and I agree with it, if it's indeed what you're saying, is hey, it's becoming more important than ever, because the playing field is continuing to slope away from the benefit of the average citizen. And if you're not paying attention, and if you're not really leaning into playing the game hard in terms of generating as much income as you can, saving as much of it as possible, and then investing it in ways that beat the rise in the cost of living, you're going to increasingly start sliding, you know, down to the uncomfortable side of that playing field.
And again, this is the problem that we see, though. You know, Adam, you and I see this all the time, is that, you know, we have people making poor financial decisions. They put themselves in that position to where they become locked in to this economic area of the economy that is going to get worse. Things are not going to get better. Capitalism works. There's nothing wrong with capitalism. You can go out and start a business today. We've talked about that before. Corporatism is a problem. We have monopoly laws that we don't enforce, right? I think we can all pretty much make a case that Amazon is a monopoly, right? So yeah. I think that's a pretty easy case to make. But we're, you know, Google, Meta, you know, I think there is a point to where companies become too large in and of themselves. And look, I'm a pure capitalist, Adam, so understand when I say this. I think that companies should be allowed to grow, right? And I think that they should be allowed to prosper and do what they want to do. But on a private basis. So if I build a company, you and I, we go out, we build a private company, and we make hundreds of millions of dollars, that's our business. But once you become public, and once you're publicly traded, I think that you have a different responsibility in terms of your shareholders, as well as to the public at large. And I think there's a point to where some of these corporations, particularly like Meta and Google, where they have a major influence on the information that we get in terms of their ability to control the flow of information, to the ability to shape opinion. I think that becomes a more dangerous structure that we need to review in order to protect the very basis of capitalism, to allow other competition to enter that market and to prosper along the overall edge of the economy. And I think there's certainly some problems there. But my point is that the way that we're heading is that we're continuing to pass policy that extracts capital from the middle class, the bottom 80%, and transfers that to the top 10 and 20% of income earners. So my point here is that we have a choice of which class do we want to be in. And if we don't want to be in that bottom 80%, we need to start thinking about how we invest, how we save, what we're doing in terms of our education, what our job prospects are. And if our job prospects aren't great, if we're in an area of the economy that's continually getting suppressed because of innovations in technology, we need to figure out how to change our job prospects in order to you know, continue to grow. And so we've got to be thinking ahead about where the economy is going and to make sure that we position ourselves and our children into a better position for the future, because the things that we're seeing now are not going to get better. There's nothing that's going to change the current landscape. AI is not going to, it's going to massively increase productivity, and it's going to lower job prospects for a vast majority of Americans. It's the same thing that happened with the dot-com bubble. The internet was great. Look what's happened with economic prosperity since the invention of the internet, because we increased productivity by so much.
So agree with everything you said. I'd love to keep talking about this. I have to sadly wrap it up because I got to jump in the car. You got to go rescue your house. I just want to underscore what you said, which is, look, folks, if you're watching this and if you're feeling a little overwhelmed, vulnerable, not exactly sure how to react yet to the stuff, that's fine. And when, you know, what you should do if you're feeling that way is just continue to educate yourself so that you can, you know, make better decisions about what you want to do going forward. I just want to underscore that if you don't know yet what step you're going to take, your priority is to get yourself educated up to the point where you can then make an informed decision, because as they say, you know, to fail to plan is to plan to fail, right? Is information by itself doesn't have value until you put it into action in your life. So, you know, everything Lance is saying is we've got the opportunity here to take and have agency in our destiny. But the only way to do that eventually is to pick a path and set priorities and start going after them. So make sure that as you're self-educating here, that you're moving towards a decision point that lets you hopefully start, you know, putting yourself in the right category that Lance is talking about. Don't be one of the victims, be one of the people that actually comes out of this okay, so that you can do well and also help your kids and help your community and the folks that depend on you. Okay.
In other words, Adam, take advantage of the victims. So...
Oh, geez, come on.
I'm joking. So I'm teasing.
I was going to say, you had everybody in the palm of your hand there cheering with you, Lance. Okay. Trades. Did you guys make any trades this week?
Yeah, I kind of went over them a little bit just, you know, as we were talking a little bit earlier. But so one thing that we had to do, we bought a position in National Fuel Gas last week.
Yep.
And we had to sell that. The reason, and again, there's nothing wrong with the company at all, right? But we manage almost, we're approaching $2 billion under management probably by the end of this year. Okay, so when we go to buy something, it requires, we have to buy a lot of shares of something. And so we have to make sure there's liquidity in that position. And so we do a lot of analysis on stock liquidity to make sure that we can get into a position and get out of a position without dramatically moving the price. So we bought National Fuel Gas, has about a 4% yield on it. We like the natural gas pipeline space in particular because of, again, we think that the demand for electricity production is going to flip over to natural gas and ultimately to nuclear, because that's going to be, that's the easiest, most efficient way to produce electricity and a lot of it. We may be wrong, but we'll see. But when we bought National Fuel Gas, it took us 2 days to buy the position because we could not get enough shares available for us to buy at one time without significantly moving the price. So the problem with that was, is we got into the position and the goal was to buy half a position. It pulls back, we buy another half. But since we couldn't get into the first half, there was no way we were buying the second half. And if we had two halves, if we had a 2% weight in the portfolio, if something fell apart and we needed to sell, there's no way to get out of the stock.
Yeah.
Without drastically dropping the price. So we very quietly sold that position over the last 2 days. And we replaced it with a position in 1OK. So 1OK is a very similar natural gas producer pipeline, pays about a 4.5% yield on it. So it kind of fit within the same theme, but has much higher volume. So we were able to get into that position very easily. As I also noted, we sold half our Visa position because of our concerns over discretionary. We sold our position in Genuine Auto Parts, same reason, for discretionary. And we also sold in our ETF model a 2%. We had about an 8% position in discretionary in our ETF model, and we reduced that by 2%.
Okay. So you basically sold a quarter of the position?
Yeah, roughly.
Okay.
I don't really think about it that way. I just think about it in percentages. So, you know, we reduced our equity by two. So we reduced the ETF sector by two. Oh, we also added a 1% stake in PSA in the equity model, which has about a 4% yield. It's a public storage for real estate. And then we added 1% of XLRE in the ETF model.
Okay. XLRE.
Again, lower interest rates coming higher, better for real estate.
Okay. All right. Okay. So just in wrapping up here, I don't have a rant, but I have a nice little story, which I'll just end it on. Something restored my faith in humanity yesterday. So I mentioned I was interviewing Jan Van Eck at this event for Thoughtful Money viewers. And I hopped on a plane, ran down there, realized I'd forgotten my jacket. And didn't want the audience to feel like, you know, I wasn't treating them with the same respect that I do every day on this channel. And it was really just kind of eating at me. They would have been fine if I walked in there just with a button-down shirt on, but it was kind of really bugging me. So as I was literally walking to the venue, I walked by the front desk of this hotel where the conversation was being had at. And I just asked the guy behind the desk there, because he was wearing a jacket. I said, hey, Do you guys have any extra ones, you know, back there that I could borrow? I'm happy to rent it, you know, for the next hour. And the guy went and looked and came back. He said, no, I'm sorry, we don't. He said, but here, just take mine. And guy literally gave me the jacket off his back. He goes, this thing wouldn't take any money. Couldn't have been nicer about it. Saved my bacon right there at the end. And it just, I wanted to share the story there. One, I wanted to thank Lorenzo. That was the gentleman who did it. Really did me a solid, but also that this guy would just take the jacket off his back for a total stranger for absolutely no benefit. Really just made me realize there's still really good people out there in the world. And even though some,
you know, and that's a very important part, because, you know, all we hear about is all the bad stuff on the news.
Exactly.
This is why I don't watch mainstream news anymore, and of any type. I don't watch financial news. I don't watch anything. I do research and I read, but, you know, you get this idea that the world's just a nasty place. And that's kind of my point about all these headlines that you were just talking about a second ago. Those are the headline stories about things that are going on. That's all the stuff we hear, right? How bad things are. But, you know, there's a lot of really good in the world. And, you know, as you and I talk about a lot, it's a much better way to go through life being optimistic than it is being pessimistic. And, you know, if you're always pessimistic about everything, it's kind of not a great way to live your life, because you're always kind of bummed out. But when you get out and start talking to people, visiting with people, you know, doing things, you'll be surprised that there's a lot of really fantastic people out there, smart, intelligent, trusting, you know, sweet people. And, you know, associate yourself with those people better. You'll feel so much better about your life when you surround yourselves if you surround yourself with optimistic people, you'll be optimistic and your life will be better. If you surround yourself with a lot of pessimistic people, you're going to be pessimistic and life's going to kind of suck. So it's kind of the same thing with, you know, talking about what our job is. What's our job? Our job is to make money and build our wealth and protect our family and grow. And it's very hard to do that if you're very pessimistic.
Well, absolutely. So, and you know, at the end of the day, we're social creatures. I talk a lot about how at the end of your life, it's your relationships that really matter to you. And to have good relationships, you have to be open to other people. And I think it's really easy for us to get, you know, insulated and whatnot and assume the worst. And I just wanted to share this story because it really helped kind of shake me out of that and said, hey, you know what? There's really good people out there in the world.
There are great people in this world. Adam, you're a great person, and I'm glad to call you a friend.
Hey, same right at you, buddy. And look,
I have two friends, you and Brent. Yeah. No, I don't like anybody else, but I like you two guys. And so that's it.
I was gonna say, you're happy to call me your friend, your only friend, but you're happy
exactly.
to call me your friend.
Exactly. Now,
right back at you, buddy. And really wish all the best for you and your family there in this time of rebuilding, and certainly all the people of Houston as well. All right. Well, look, in wrapping up, if Lance is one of your best online friends, please let him know by hitting the like button, then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. If you would like to get guidance with, you know, any of the financial issues that we've talked about or decisions that you're making in your life, for most people watching, as you've heard me say many times before, I think you should go work with a good financial advisor, but one that takes into account all the issues that Lance and I have been talking about here. when you layer those two requirements on atop of each other, the universe of financial advisors available to do that gets pretty small. But if you've got one of them that's good and treating you right, stick with them. But if not, or you'd like a second opinion from one who does, maybe even Lance and his team there at RIA, consider scheduling a consultation with them. Just go to thoughtfulmoney.com to do that. It only takes a couple seconds to fill out that form. Just a reminder, these guys want to talk to you, but only fill out that form if you're at a point where you're ready to really engage with them and take action. Like I said, we're kind of beginning to become victims of our own success, where a lot of people are requesting these consultations, which is great. We want to help as many people as possible, but it really helps them if you're prepared and in the right mindset to take action based upon what you guys talk about. All right. And then also, if you also go to thoughtfulmoney.com, that's where you sign up for our free newsletter. And just a reminder, premium newsletter subscribers enjoy all the benefits of premium membership. But we've got the new MacroPass service out there that folks are really liking. Just wanted to let you know that this week's MacroPass report is coming from Edwin Dorsey, author of The Bear Cave, who is looking out there at short opportunities and has a new report out that he thinks is some of his best work. So I'll be a little cryptic about it, but if you're interested in that, go read the MacroPass for this week. All right, Lance, my friend, always great doing this with you. Thanks for another week. Thanks especially for doing it this week when your life has just been turned upside down by the storm. Really appreciate it, buddy.
It's always my pleasure. And look, my wife's in London right now, so she's escaped the whole thing. So
okay. Lucky her. Lucky her, though. I'm sure she's nervous about you and probably really the dogs, right? Yeah. All right, my friend. Well, good luck with that. If we can help in any way, just say the word.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right, everybody else, thanks so much for watching.